From the JAMA Network, this is Conversations with Dr. Bauchner. Interviews featuring researchers and thinkers in healthcare about their publications in the latest issue of JAMA.
Hello and welcome to This Author Interview. This is Howard Bauchner, Editor-in-Chief of JAMA, and I'm here with Robert Troon, Bob Troon. Welcome, Bob.
Welcome, Howard. Thank you for having me.
So this is Conversations with Dr. Bauchner. Bob is the Francis Glessner Lee Professor of Medical Ethics, Anesthesia, and Pediatrics, the Director of the Center of Bioethics at Harvard Medical School, and a Senior Associate in Critical Care Medicine at Boston Children's. Bob's here to talk about one of the most interesting topics in medicine, understanding brain death. That's the title of the Viewpoint. But Bob, before we begin, could you say something about your two co-authors, Aaron and Robert?
Sure. Aaron Paquette is a pediatric intensivist like myself. I got to know her when she was doing her fellowship training at Boston Children's Hospital. She's currently at Lurie Children's Hospital in Chicago. And Robert Tasker, who you also know well, Howard, is a British neurologist. He's now at Boston Children's Hospital, where he is chief of neurocritical care.
I've known Robert for about 10 years when I was in the BMJ system as editor of Archives of Disease and Childhood. Robert was one of our associate editors. He's an incredible thinker around critical care, neurology, and brain well-being. So we're going to talk about the concept of brain death. And this really begins in the 60s with both the Beecher Report in 1968 as well as the Uniform Determination of Death Act. So Bob, before we start, this is such a fascinating topic. Can you tell me how you got interested in this subject?
I think, you know, ever since my residency, I was intrigued by the idea of brain death, but it really came home to me when I became an attending at Boston Children's Hospital. And, you know, I've had this experience so many times of being at a bed space of a child that I have diagnosed as being brain dead. And, you know, looking at the child, you know, in the next bed space over, and they look basically the same. You know, the one next door has her eyes closed, is non-responsive, needs a ventilator to breathe, and yet we expect to completely recover. And so, you know, children side by side appearing to be virtually identical, and yet we consider one of them to be alive and one of them dead. And that was one of the things that just got me to think much more deeply about what brain death means, and it's something that has fascinated me now for over 30 years.
I think one of the things that have changed has been the technology surrounding care in the critical care unit, and I think that's made it more complicated. What did the Beecher report say?
Well, you know, to understand the Beecher report, you have to go back to the end of World War II and the development of mechanical ventilation. Through the 1950s, the 1960s, what physicians were seeing were these patients with these massive brain injuries that would have been quickly fatal, but for the fact that they were put on a ventilator. And as long as they were on the ventilator, they would be kept alive. And yet, you know, the doctors knew that there was virtually no chance that these patients were ever going to wake up. And so in the 60s, when Beecher was there, they were facing this dilemma about what do we do with these patients? And, you know, on the one hand, they were worried that they might overrun the ICUs and take up beds that could be used for people with a chance of recovery. And this was also the beginning of the era of organ transplantation. And so there was this thought that, well, if we could consider them to be dead, then maybe these organs that are still being perfused and oxygenated could be used to save the lives of other people. And so that was the context that Beecher faced in 1968 when he chaired this, you know, now famous Harvard committee that came up with these criteria for declaring these patients brain dead, still pretty much the same criteria that we use today.
And then over about a 15-year period, I think people reflect on them, and then they're adopted into the Uniform Determination of Death Act, which is now widely known as the UDDA, in 1981. Does that change anything fundamentally, or does it hold to what Beecher defined as brain dead?
It's a fascinating question. When Beecher proposed his criteria, people asked, what have we done here? Is this a new definition of death? Is this a new way of being dead? And it's pretty clear that Beecher thought that it was. In his writings, you can tell that he thought that once a person was never going to wake up again, they had lost this essential human capacity and that they were dead. But by 1981, when the UDDA was made a law, the authors of that law completely rejected this idea. They thought it was very important that death be a unified concept. And, you know, basically their idea was as follows, that the brain kind of functions as command central for the body, organizes all of the body's activities. And that when the brain stops functioning, the body literally disintegrates. And so that whenever brain death was diagnosed, a cardiac arrest would follow almost imminently. And they were so close together that in the mind of the UDDA's authors, they were one and the same thing, that brain death was the same thing as cardiac arrest.
So Beecher writes, you have a wonderful quote in The Viewpoint, when consciousness is permanently lost, that is the moment of death. And so then the UDDA is published in 1981, and that establishes the law in the United States and many other countries around the world for decades, correct?
Correct.
And then what happens over the last 10 years, and I think you and I are quite familiar with a very well-known case of Jaheed McMath, but it's not the only case that raises issues about the definition of death.
Right. What the Jaheed McMath case did was really challenge this view that brain death is the same thing as biological death or cardiac arrest. This had been the accepted view of the United States for more than 40 years. But we now have a number of cases that show that it's just not true. So, you know, Jahi McMath, a young woman who's diagnosed as brain dead after a postoperative hemorrhage, she goes on to live for almost 5 more years biologically, doing really everything that a living person does, except that she is unconscious and cannot breathe on her own. And there have been many other cases like this, the most dramatic being somebody who lived biologically for more than 20 years after the diagnosis was made. And so this it very much shows that brain death is not synonymous with biological death. And so I think this presents a challenge to the way that brain death has been typically viewed in the United States. As, you know, as counterintuitive as it may seem, I think we now know that the body does not always need a brain in order to continue with biological life.
You have a wonderful question in The Viewpoint. If brain death is neither the absence of all brain function nor the biological death of the person, then what is it? Can you answer that question?
Right. So yes, if brain death is not the complete absence of all brain function or biological death, then what is it? And I think this provides a wonderful opportunity for us to be more clear about what brain death means. If you look at the diagnostic criteria that we use, conceptually, we can think of brain death as irreversible apneic unconsciousness. Irreversible apneic unconsciousness. And let me just say a word about how we diagnose those. So right now, we determine unconsciousness by showing that the patient has no response to painful stimuli and has no brainstem reflexes. Now, the brainstem reflexes are interesting because, of course, whether a person is alive or dead has nothing to do with whether their pupils react to light. But the reason we focus so carefully on the brainstem is because there's a structure in the brainstem called the reticular activating system, and it enables us to be awake. And we can't test for that directly. So what we do is we test the brainstem nuclei that are also in the brainstem in close proximity to the RAS, and we infer that if those nuclei are not working, then the RAS is not working either, and that gives us confirmatory evidence that the patient is actually unconscious. For apnea, we take the patient off the ventilator and we allow the carbon dioxide level to rise to a high level, and we show that the patient is not capable of breathing. And for irreversibility, we assume that it's irreversible because we should know the cause of the injury and know that it's a non-recoverable injury, and also because we rule out reversible causes like sedative drugs. So that, in a nutshell, is how we diagnose it, and also conceptually what brain death means: irreversible apneic unconsciousness.
Now, how does that create conflicts with the UDDA, does it?
Yes, because irreversible apneic unconsciousness is not the same as biological death, which is sort of the position that we've had in the United States. And so the question that comes up then is, okay, it's not biological death, but can we consider it to be equivalent to biological death? Can we say that these patients are legally dead? And this is where I was so interested to see what the British position is on this. The British do not have a law around brain death, but they do have a code of practice from the Academy of Royal Medical Colleges. And I'll read you the sentence just because it's only one sentence, but it captures the idea. They say that death entails the irreversible loss of those essential characteristics which are necessary to the existence of a living human person. And thus, the definition of death should be regarded as the irreversible loss of the capacity for consciousness combined with the irreversible loss of the capacity to breathe. So the British don't make any pretense that brain death is biological death. Basically, what they're saying is this is a value judgment that our society has made, that when you're never going to wake up again and you're never going to breathe on your own again, our view is that we will consider you to be dead. And I find this to be a remarkably clear and coherent way of tying together the meaning of brain death with the diagnostic criteria that we use.
It's interesting because during my back and forth to London when I was editor-in-chief of Archives of Disease and Childhood, every few years there'd be a child who the pediatric community or whoever was caring for the child would want to take the person off the ventilator, and the parents would protest. And this often would end up going to the Supreme Court equivalent of the UK. And they almost always sided with the clinicians who would use this definition of death.
That's right. I think you can see the strength of the British position compared to ours, because when parents in the United States object to the diagnosis of brain death, it's kind of like, well, pardon the term, a no-brainer to them that their child is not biologically dead. Their child looks like, you know, the child in the next bed space. And so, you know, they say, what do you mean? This is not biological death. And it's a pretty good argument. Whereas, as you point out, in Britain, they don't make that claim at all. They say, no, our society has made this value judgment. It's something that we all live by. And then I think the judiciary is in a much stronger place to back up the clinicians.
Can we get there in the United States, Bob?
Well, I think there's one thing that's really pushing us, and that is that the UDDA states that brain death is the irreversible cessation of all brain function, And we've known for a long time that the diagnostic criteria that we use look at only a certain number of functions. And we know that many patients who meet our current diagnostic criteria actually do retain some brain functions, most commonly those of the hypothalamus. So there is this rather urgent problem that the diagnostic criteria that we use probably do not fulfill the letter of the law. And that, you know, creates an opportunity for many legal problems. Were we to adopt the British standard, we would solve that problem because the British standard does not call for the absence of all functions of the entire brain. I think the more important advantage of moving to the British model, though, is that it would allow us to revise and refine the criteria that we currently use. You know, I mentioned that the standards we use today are really the same ones that we've used since 1968. Hard to think of many diagnoses where the diagnostic criteria have not been refined over time. And we know that there's a very limited evidence base for the ones that we use. And so by getting clarity about what brain death means and defining it as irreversible apneic unconsciousness, it would allow us to refine our diagnostic standards. For example, one area of concern is How sure are we that these patients are unconscious? We know that in diagnosing unconsciousness in patients in a persistent vegetative state, we know that neurologists are wrong 40% of the time. How does that relate to our diagnosis of brain death? There's also safety concerns. Part of the testing is the apnea test, where we allow the carbon dioxide level to rise to a very high level, which, if we weren't pretty sure that the patient was already dead, would clearly be a medical error. Are there safer ways of diagnosing irreversible apnea? I think one of the things we've lost by not being clear about what brain death means is that we failed to be able to incorporate the modern imaging techniques that we have, you know, the very sophisticated MRIs, PET scans, et cetera, and the diagnostic technologies that we have. We failed to take advantage of how to make the routine diagnosis of brain death more robust in terms of us being confident that the patient is really unconscious, apneic, and that these findings are irreversible.
In the 50s, 60s, even into the 70s, the practice of medicine was somewhat autocratic. That obviously has changed over the last two or three decades, and I think patients, their families, are much more involved in care than they had been perhaps when I was younger, certainly when my parents were younger. How do you move this discussion forward? What group could be vested in trying to create a new UDDA?
I think the first step is developing some agreement within the medical community about what brain death means. I think the notion that it is equivalent to and indistinguishable from cardiac arrest is just no longer tenable. And I think people are concerned that if we move to that position, that what will happen to things like organ donation? What will happen to ICU utilization? How will the public respond to that? And I think this is a big fear in the medical profession. I don't know what the answer to that is, but I do think we've had almost an experiment of nature, if you will, because in New Jersey, there has been a law which allows patients and families to opt out of the diagnosis of brain death. And they've had that law for over 25 years. So in a sense, by sort of acknowledging that brain death is not biological death, we can look to New Jersey, you know, and we can say, well, what has been the effect of allowing patients to object to that diagnosis? And as far as I can tell, there's been no impact at all on ICU utilization or organ procurement. So I think some of the fears of the medical profession about what if we let go of this idea that brain death is the same as biological death, I would hope that actually being more transparent and honest with the public would be a good thing and would lead to greater confidence in our medical system. And not something to be feared.
This is one of the great ethical, philosophical, and religious questions of any era, just not the current era. Obviously, technology now influences the way we think about it. You have an incredible sense of how this is operationalized or how it plays out around the country. Are there many cases that aren't resolved between patient's family and physicians and end up in court? Or is it still rare that there's substantial disagreements between families and physicians?
Yes, you know, I think it is rare that there are substantial disagreements. In my mind, it doesn't really hinge around whether we consider these patients to be biologically dead or not. When I sit down with families and I say, we've done testing that give me great confidence that your child is never going to wake up again, never breathe on a ventilator, the next thing families say is, well, you know, what are next steps? We clearly don't want to continue with life support. Are there opportunities perhaps for us to donate organs to save the lives of other children? The conversation so often flows that way. And the question of whether the child is actually dead or not is often irrelevant to the family. What they're interested in is, well, what does this mean for my child? What's the prognosis? What can I do for others? And I think that we've built too much of this conversation around, you know, is this really death, as opposed to the conversation around, you know, what does this mean and where do we go from here? So I think in some ways, maybe we in the medical profession have made a bigger deal of this than the public sees, and that being more straightforward with the public about the meaning of brain death and what it means is not going to have the sort of feared consequences that some people imagine.
So my last question about this issue, and this is really a fascinating viewpoint, one of the more intensely emotional ones that I think we've published since I've been at JAMA. So you do deal with different families, and you deal with families of different religious and spiritual backgrounds and from different cultures. How does that intersect with these discussions?
So death does vary widely, or the definitions of death do vary widely around the world. And as you point out, depend heavily upon culture and religion and moral philosophy and all of those things. The question is, to what extent do we respect these different viewpoints versus to what extent do we think it's important that we have this uniform understanding of death in our country? Again, people are concerned that if we allow for religious exemptions to brain death, that could have catastrophic consequences. I think the experience in New Jersey would tell us that maybe that's not as great a concern as some people feel, and that maybe being willing to respect different views about when death occurs, allowing families to not accept the diagnosis of brain death, may actually be the best path forward without having drastic consequences or really significant consequences at all on ICU utilization and organ procurement. So my own view, and it's a debatable view, and there's definitely another side to it, but my own view is that we should be more accepting of different religious and philosophical positions and not insist on imposing our own views about when we declare a person dead.
This is Howard Bochner, Editor-in-Chief of JAMA. This has been Conversations with Dr. Bochner. I've been talking with Bob Truden, who's the Francis Glessner Lee Professor of Medical Ethics, Anesthesia, and Pediatrics at Harvard Medical School, who, along with his two co-authors, has written a fascinating, provocative viewpoint entitled Understanding Brain Death. Bob, thanks so much for joining me today.
Oh, Howard, thank you for the opportunity. It's been a pleasure to talk with you.
And for those who are listening, for more podcasts, please visit us at jamanetworkaudio.com. You can subscribe to our podcasts on Stitcher and Apple Podcasts, and in any way that you get your podcasts.